Today is the day when we present our ofrendas, our offering of sounds, honoring the lives of those who have left us. This is the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
Ofrenda, a decimation of people, a celebration of life. We'll take a look at the soothing tradition of remembering the dead. On a year where Texas has been hit again by natural disasters, a global pandemic, and an economy that is fighting to stay afloat, we still have a presidential election coming up. We'll see Texans pulling together to feed each other, and how the mystery of the monarch butterfly invites us to think about rebirth and the afterlife. This is the Texas Standard. My father died in 2014, and while his life faded away, I sang for him. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown with a special edition of the Texas Standard. Ofrenda, a decimation of people, a celebration of life. Today is Friday, October 30th, 2020. Normally, we would be talking about the election and the last day of early voting, but not today. Please take a moment and just pause. Today, we'll be spending time speaking about the end of life. Why? Because COVID-19 has been brutally cruel on Texans. El Paso and Lubbock have seen the most recent spikes, and every corner of this otherwise powerful state is wailing. We've lost close to 18,000 Texans to COVID-19. I remember it was 5 in the morning that day in 2014 when my mother called. "Joy, it's time," she said. I knew what that meant. My father's life was leaving us. My children drew a card with stick figures waving him goodbye. My husband played my father's favorite songs on the guitar. This was our tribute to him, our ofrenda, our offering. One luxury my family enjoyed is that we had time to process and prepare, but close to 18,000 families in Texas had not been afforded that luxury. COVID-19 has ripped them of the soothing grace of whispering their goodbyes in their loved one's ear while someone else strokes their hair, or the privilege of icing their lips when they were too weak to drink on their own. The loss is unbearable and heavy, and it has not been evenly distributed. One community has been ravaged more than others. Infectious disease expert and Baylor College of Medicine dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine, Dr. Peter Hotez, puts it this way.
I think we're seeing historic decimation of Hispanic communities.
Hotez spoke with us in July, but back in March, nobody was talking about a decimation of people. Rogelio Saenz, a professor of demography at the University of Texas at San Antonio, however, he suspected something was wrong with the way Texas was reporting its COVID-19 numbers at the beginning of the pandemic. Even today, he says, there has been an undercounting of cases among Hispanics in Texas.
Well, I started collecting data from different state data portals back in about March or so. There were a lot of problems originally, given the way Latinos are identified. Mm. And then a lot of states, what they were doing is not separating Latinos from the white population for those individuals that classified themselves as white. And then really where it really stood out, I was writing a monthly blog for Latino Decisions, looking at the trends that were taking place in the Latino community with respect to the impact of COVID. But this was back in June and July, where we really were having those spikes that were taking place as the economy was opening up. You could see in the data trends that California stood out in terms of Latinos being disproportionately represented mm-hmm. among the dead, in Arizona as well as in Florida. But Texas kind of lagged behind, and that got me suspicious. And then as I started digging more into the data, you were finding out that a lot of people who had died, as well as people who had contracted the virus, were not being identified so that you didn't have For the large majority of individuals, you didn't have their racial and Latino identification.
And you're right that talking about Hispanics is such a difficult way to break it down, because we have Afro-Latinos and we have white Latinos and we have brown Latinos and we have all colors and shapes. And then it's difficult because when it comes to racial breakdown, how do you identify a person? How do you know that a community is being decimated, as Dr. Hotez says?
Yes, that's true. And one of the things, however, that Texas really stood out is that many other states weren't having this problem in terms of here in Texas, for people who had contracted the virus. We're talking about 93% of individuals that had contracted the virus did not have a racial or ethnic identification. Mm. So that even though it was devastating what is happening here in Texas, it was based on really a small portion of the entire people who had contracted the virus.
So at the time, you decided to track the data yourself. You decided to report the data yourself.
Right.
And I wonder why. Do you feel the weight of history on your shoulders?
Well, yeah, it was that you were seeing a lot. And I am extremely thankful for journalists who were really getting the story out back in March and April, because they were painting. It was very obvious that this was a great devastation. And there tended to be extremely limited information on Latinos. And that's where I started compiling the data. So I would go every week and try to update. And it was very time consuming and so forth, because you're making methodological decisions and so forth on the spur of the moment. Fortunately, by about May or so, we began seeing, at first there were about maybe 15, 17 states that were releasing data on the Latino population, and that has gotten better, but there's still about 5 or 6 states around the country that still do not present data on Latino infections or deaths.
Reading your writings, I sense a level of sometimes cynicism, sometimes frustration. And we're speaking about numbers. Why do numbers elicit these emotions in you?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I often say that behind these cold numbers really lie lives, people who are just being devastated, families that have been losing loved ones and so forth. So that it is always important to remember that behind these cold numbers, that there's really human beings that are the ones that are being impacted. And I think that here in Texas in particular, I think the Latino community has always lagged significantly behind socially and economically compared to Latinos in other parts of the country. And I think that in many respects, that reflects the very limited kind of safety net that we have here in Texas. About 30% of Latinos that are 19 to 64 years of age do not have health care insurance. And I think that in many respects, what we're seeing with the pandemic is really part of those decisions that policymakers have made in terms of being extremely stingy with providing the health care, the educational, housing, and so forth needs that are the basic needs of people, that we find in many respects better kinds of opportunities in other parts of the country.
Numbers are rising. We talk about first wave and second wave, but it feels like we are in a endless cycle of waves, and numbers are rising, hospitalizations are rising. And I think the only question that my brain is able to process is why? Why the decimation of communities of color?
And this is where I think you kind of picked up a cynicism in my writing. And that is, I think that it is communities of color, particularly Latinos and African Americans, that are dying from COVID. Here in Texas in particular, Texas is the only state that continues to be the only state where Latinos account for more than 50% of the deaths. If you look at children less than 18 years of age, all of the kids that have died have been Latinos. Here in Texas, Latinos are dying at a rate that is 4 times higher than the white population after you take age differences into account. And then another of these differences that you find is that both in the U.S. and here in Texas, close to 90% of whites who have died have been persons 65 and older. But just to give you kind of a perspective, here in Texas, about 11% of Latinos who die are less than 50 years of age, compared to only 3% of whites. So in many respects, I think when you see who is dying, who is catching the virus, and people are, the reason is that you have Latinos and African Americans that are on the front lines, that have been on the front lines since the pandemic started and continue to be people who do not have the luxury of being able to work from home, that they're at greater risk, and you have issues regarding poverty, issues regarding limited resources, issues regarding people living in multi-generational homes and so forth. And you can see just the basics in terms of wearing a mask that has become a political issue. And I think that we are the people that are paying the price for that. And the other one, I think, is the fact that Texas pushed very aggressively, was one of the states around the country that pushed aggressively for opening the state for business and so forth. And I think that represented also a major hit on the Latino community and the African-American community. Again, people that were in the front lines and so forth, that in many respects kind of represented that kind of fodder for opening the economy.
Rogelio Saenz is a professor of demography at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He's been tracking the undercounting of COVID-19 cases among Hispanics. Professor, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
Día de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, is Sunday. We are listening to La Llorona, the Wailing Woman, a song often associated with Día de los Muertos, the day when the Latinx community presents ofrendas, offerings to the departed. They usually consist of an image of those who are gone. For the radio, we'll use audio portraits. The ofrenda also includes their favorite music, their favorite foods, and other favorite colorful items. Those are all elements you'll hear here as we build our ofrenda. When we remember those who have left us, we believe their lives are not over. That's why we celebrate. That's why we've asked you to join us. Social media editor Wells Dunbar has been collecting your stories. Hi, Wells.
Hi, Joy. It's good to be with you. And that's right.
Thank
you. We are looking to hear from our friends and listeners out there who might feel like sharing their remembrances of loved ones with us. They can reach out to us on our Facebook page, just search for Texas Standard, and also on Twitter. We're eager to hear and share those stories of those close to you.
We'll be right back.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org.
There were certain songs, like She Loves Tina Turner. So that was one of the songs we played at her funeral, Simply the Best. You're simply the best. Better than all the rest. My mom was, she was the strongest person I've known. I've never seen her break. She had been a nurse for 46 years. She was in the Army. She was just really tough. We had a real rocky relationship when I was growing up because I was so rebellious. But she was always there, praying for me and never giving up on me. I'm just glad she got to see me get accepted in the nursing school because, you know, I started over at 41.
Mother's Day would be the last time that me and my family would actually see her. My mom was in a nursing home. She was always creating something. She used to turn plastic bottles into flowers. And people used to buy these flowers from her. They loved them so much. our last conversation, she was gasping for air a little. I think my mom knew that. I think that my mom knew she was going to die. The last thing she told me was, when you get to heaven, we'll find each other.
Let me tell you how my mom died. On June 28th, my mother told my brother that she wasn't feeling well. The day before, she took note of her symptoms in a journal. Dizziness, lightheaded, chills, body aches, huge headache, shaking and drowsy, and a fever at 100.8 degrees, all at once at 10:30 p.m. She was a respiratory therapist. She was a woman who quite literally saved the lives of many. Despite having a loving family and many friends, she died alone less than 1 week after testing positive for coronavirus.
I'm a funeral director here in Austin, Texas, and the proud owner of Mission Funeral Homes. And my mother and father founded our funeral home in July of 1959. You know, I'm used to seeing death. It doesn't escape us all, no matter what. In this particular instance, I've seen, you know, so much death, you know, in such a short time where families are forced to be courageous. My mother, she did pass away of COVID, and she had blonde hair and green eyes, and a lot of people would have never thought that she spoke Spanish or that she even was Hispanic. She spoke beautiful Spanish. You know, she was a family of a migrant farm family, and she worked in the field. She did everything that you can imagine, and here she is, you know, beautiful woman. Her signature is when she would go on a funeral that she'd always wear a hat, and the hat was out of dignity and respect. You know, I miss her, you know, eternally, you know, always.
The voice of Charles Villaseñor honoring Lois Villaseñor from Austin, Vienna Tulip honoring Isabel Papadimitriou from Brownsville, Rosie Davis honoring Mary Castro from Irving, and April Zavala Wallace honoring Beverly Zavala Weaver from Marlin, Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. One Texas region COVID-19 has hit especially hard is the Rio Grande Valley. Since the pandemic began, the virus has killed more than 3,000 people there. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leanez Jr. talked to one RGV resident about how the virus has upended her life and motivated her to vote more than ever.
Please answer the questions below based on the circumstances.
In a headset sitting at the computer, Ana Hernandez is working remotely. From her home in McAllen, Texas, she's part of a COVID-19 task force for New York City.
Are one or more members of her household currently staying home under the advice?
Hernandez started this job months ago when the pandemic started. She worked as a medical office specialist at a clinic in the Rio Grande Valley. She says doctors weren't hearing her concerns or her colleagues.
So I quit before because of that. I said, no, these doctors are not willing to protect us.
Now, she says, she knows people who've died from coronavirus, like thousands of other Latinos.
Health-wise, COVID-19 is affecting the Latino community particularly hard.
That's Rodrigo Dominguez Villegas, director of research at the Latino Policy and Politics Initiative at UCLA. He's also the co-author of a report on the top issues Latino voters care about in swing states with large Latino populations.
Poll after poll is showing that the Latino voter cares a lot about health, about the economy, and most importantly, about COVID-19.
One reason the virus is affecting Latinos more is because there's an overrepresentation of Latinos in essential jobs and sectors like agriculture and construction, jobs where it's hard to maintain social distance or where they're not able to work from home.
Also, there's a lot of Latinos in the health industry, so a lot of nurses, a lot of doctors are Latino.
Like Ana Hernandez. That data Dominguez Villegas analyzed shows Latino voters want to see a clear path and leadership to stop the virus, something Hernandez can relate to.
I've always been active in the communities, but, this administration has changed me, my job. It's changed my family. It's changed my faith. Before, I would just vote, and sometimes I vote Republican. But because of this administration, we just changed our ways of looking into everything.
The virus and the election have disrupted her home life, too. Hernandez has three adult children. One son and her daughter are voting for Vice President Biden. As for her other son,
I have a young son. He's 26. He, for some reason, doesn't think, like many other people, think that this is not serious. He listens to Trump, so he doesn't take precautions.
She remembers one night.
I couldn't sleep, just thinking this virus is going to kill one of us. It's going to kill my daughter. Maybe it's going to kill my husband or me. And it was because of him.
Her daughter is a cancer survivor.
I love him. But they got to the point that I said, okay, you can stay home. You want to be out, going to your barbershop, going to bars. I cannot sleep because you do this. I'm going to ask you to leave the house.
Hernandez is in a slight majority in Texas. According to a Dallas Morning News and University of Texas at Tyler poll, Biden is leading with 48% of support from Texas likely voters, while President Trump is polling at 45%. And among Latinos, Biden is polling better than Trump. Hernandez says she went to vote early. In line, she heard her thoughts echoed by fellow voters.
And I was listening to conversations. They seem to have gone up early to vote and they want to change. That's what I was observing. People that hadn't never voted, they're going. And you could hear conversations, oh yeah, I lost my friend, or I lost my comadre. And then I even shared, yes, I've lost many friends.
Hernandez says she's hopeful a Biden administration would help bring a quicker end to the COVID-19 pandemic and bring together a divided country. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Mission.
The pandemic has impacted almost every aspect of life in Texas. Has it impacted who you're voting for? Email texasstandard@kut.org or share with us on social media. And while you're there, add your departed loved ones to our virtual ofrenda. We're honoring those who have gone before us, particularly in this year when we've lost so many. Our special program, Ofrenda, A Decimation of People, A Celebration of Life, continues in just a few minutes.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Heading into the last day of early voting in Texas, the number of people in the state who have already cast ballots has now surpassed the total votes cast in the 2016 presidential election. More than 9 million Texans have already voted. That accounts for just over half of all registered voters in the state. The only state that has cast more ballots than Texas during the early voting period is California, with more than 9.1 million. The El Paso County judge is facing criticism from local and state officials for ordering a 2-week shutdown of non-essential services to contain the area's ongoing coronavirus crisis. Cases in El Paso are soaring and hospitals are overwhelmed, with more than 939 COVID-19 patients. Judge Ricardo Samaniego announced the closures last night.
The hard truth is that the people who are dying are El Pasoans. They are not in Austin.
He said the shutdown affects businesses like hair salons and gyms. Restaurants can no longer offer in-person dining, but polling places will remain open. Shortly after the announcement, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton tweeted the shutdown violates the governor's executive order and his office is exploring legal actions. El Paso Mayor DeMargo also said Judge Samaniego did not consult him on the shutdown. Dallas County District Attorney John Cruzo is asking for help investigating police use of force during protests against systemic racism and police brutality earlier this year. KERA's Christopher Connolly reports no charges have been filed against officers yet, but the DA's office is trying to determine whether the incidents warrant criminal charges.
Cruzo says he launched an investigation after he saw news stories about a man losing an eye after an officer shot him with what police describe as a less-than-lethal weapon. In another incident captured by a photographer at the same May 30th protest, a Dallas police sergeant appears to shoot a woman in the chest with pepper balls at close range. A third incident identified by the DA's office involves a person seriously injured by a police projectile.
What we're interested in seeing is the direction of the projectile. We want to see it from the firing all the way, if we can, to the contact with the individuals. That's important to us. We don't know if these are crimes. We're investigating them. Obviously, they're potentially crimes, and so we want to be certain.
The DA's office is asking people to call or email if they have video of any of these or other incidents where police used force and injured protesters. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
And I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from UT Austin's Value Institute for Health and Care, now enrolling for Financial Acumen, a value-based introduction, a four-week online executive education course designed for healthcare professionals. More at utvalueinstitute.org.
My mom's favorite color is purple. When my mom was in the hospital, she was telling us not to lose faith. So a lot of the women in our family, after she passed away, we all got a small faith tattoo on our arm. Mostly everybody got it splashed with purple watercolor in honor of my mom.
He was a sweet kid. All of my kids were good kids. He always took care of me and worried about me. When he started feeling sick, he said, "Dad, don't come near me. I think it's COVID." Within a month, my other son was also dead. I lost my two boys. And I asked God, "What's going on? If this is punishment for something, it's too much."
My father smelled like Old Spice. You know, my parents got divorced when I was young, and I remember every summer I would get to go with him or he would come into town, and I just would bawl my eyes out when he had to leave or when I had to come home. We'd call each other about the sports, about Astros, the Spurs. I showed him how to use Pandora, and he was so happy. He had no idea that that existed.
The voices of Veronica Gonzalez honoring Johnny G. Gonzalez from Houston, Valdemar Diaz honoring Ilmar Diaz from Rio Grande City, Caitlin Urenda Culpepper honoring Genevieve Martinez from El Paso. This is a special edition of the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. An important part of the ofrenda is the music a person enjoyed in life. A few years ago, when classical guitarist Salvador Garcia was in grad school, his family experienced a series of painful months where several family members died, one after the other, and Garcia couldn't attend his family members' funerals. Garcia will tell us the rest of the story, but right now I want to introduce him and Joe Williams. They are co-artistic directors of Austin Classical Guitar, and this year, for the first time, ACG is honoring the dead with musical ofrendas, musical tributes, in partnership with Mexicarte Museum in Austin. Joe and Salvador, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Happy to be
Thank
here.
Thank you, Joy.
Salvador, I understand that that painful year, when you visited your mother, you were shocked by what you saw.
Yeah, what happened was that I had just started grad school a couple of years back. It was difficult for me to make the trip from Texas all the way to Mexico City. However, months later, when I made the visit to my parents' home, it just happened to be around the Dia de Muertos celebrations. And as I walk in, you know, my parents had their altar set up there. And, you know, it was a very emotional experience. But at the same time, it's a happiness to know that I had at least that tradition to deal with some grief and be able to celebrate the life that I shared with them.
And these ofrendas, these altars, are such a stimuli to the senses. It's about smell, it's about color, it's about music. Joe, Austin Classical Guitar is a 30-year-old nonprofit. Why is this the first time you all are doing ofrendas? It seems to me that it's like we should have been doing them every year.
I think you're absolutely right. We should have. And now seemed like an important time to start. We invited artists from Texas to reflect on this concept and make new pieces, to make videos. And so we asked Nakia Reynoso and Graham Reynolds and Carrie Rodriguez and many others, including members of our community ensembles. And many of the artists commented that they didn't know that they needed this.
Yes.
And so grateful that they were part of a community that was making this.
Salvador, even though Dia de Muertos has become a Latinx celebration in Texas, the ofrendas are not just honoring the Latinx community, because it's not the only community that has suffered losses during COVID-19. So tell me a little bit more about those who participated. I know you have partners all over.
Sure. You know, as an artist, when you get a commission, you're always careful to try and stick to the guidelines of what the project entails, right? Because we have classical guitar in our name, many of the artists that we reached out to were kind of worried. So for us, I wanted to give them that space of just like, this is a tradition where we honor and love those who we remember best. And sometimes, you know, the way that you remember your loved ones can be emotional, can be sad, but other times it comes out as joyful. And I think that's a great experience to be part of.
The music you've been hearing is part of the ofrendas that Salvador Garcia and Joe Williams put together. They directed ofrendas for Austin Classical Guitar in collaboration with Mexicarte Museum. Salvador, Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
My mom always loved a pot of like beans cooking on the stove. When I smell that, like, I think of my mom. She was just the fun mom. Like, she worked for LULAC for 35 years. You know, she loved her job, but if an opportunity came to like do field trips or any type of school function, she would always volunteer. You know, I was really into New Kids on the Block at that time, and it'd be a bunch of like screaming tweens and teenagers and my mom, you know, as long as we were happy, she was happy.
My dad was always barbecuing. That was his thing, his favorite thing to do. So that is one of the, you know, the scents that it's going to remind me of, like my dad. We were economically struggling, right? Because my dad, he had a stroke when he was a baby. Like, he couldn't really see with one eye, so he had to have surgery. You know, they had to, like, partially close it because his eye would never close. His arm, like, he could move it, but it would hurt him. He pushed himself a lot because he was bullied so much as a child. He made us a seesaw. He made us swings. Like, he was a very crafty and intelligent man. He also made us a buggy. So while everybody had a Hot Wheel, we actually had a real tiny car.
The voice of Melissa Rangel remembering Juan Carlos Rangel from Brownsville, and Cristina Gomez remembering Helen Flores from Houston, Texas. This is a special edition of the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz, presenting Ofrenda, a Decimation of People, a Celebration of Life.
Hi, my name is Mariela Camacho. I am the owner and baker for Comadre Panaderia. Pan de Muerto to me is a reminder of my family, you know, what my parents and what my grandparents have been through. And to be able to make something that reminds me of all these people that I love is just like, it's so precious and it's so important. So for this dough, like the base to a lot of sweetbreads is a brioche dough, and that's what this is. So we're just gonna mix this until all the ingredients come together, and you just wanna develop the gluten in the wheat a bit. And then we're gonna turn it off for like 5 to 10 minutes so that it can rest and settle and all of the liquid absorbs into the flour. So now we are gonna start adding the butter slowly, and your mixer is gonna do all of the work. During COVID, so much loss this year on so many levels. And I think people are really needing
some positivity, some comfort, and I think embracing the practice of Dia de los Muertos, I think it's really comforting and special for them, and I really hope that people like honor their ancestors and the people that they've lost through this. The next day, I pull out my cold brioche dough, shape two little rounds, take tiny little balls, and I roll it out like snakes. You create these little shapes with your fingers and just place them on top of your little ball, making an X. They usually signify the bones, and the one right in the middle is meant to symbolize the skull. So now that they're out of the oven, I'm going to brush some melted butter on them. Once I've covered the hot little pan de muerto, I have a sugar mixer ready. So you just want to cover your pan de muerto and a lot of sugar. My name is Mariela Camacho. I am the owner and baker for Comadre Panaderia. You're listening to the Texas Standard.
The food in an ofrenda is meant to bring our late loved ones back together with the family, welcoming them home with their favorite meal. But for many in this pandemic, eating a solid meal hasn't been guaranteed. As the Standard's Kristen Cabrera reports, some can find that sense of togetherness in places where their neighbors are willing to step up.
It's almost lunchtime, and Roy Coronado, his wife Jeanette, and their five-year-old daughter Ariana are outside a taqueria in East Austin. It's closed, but that's okay. The family isn't there for takeout. They came because of the refrigerator outside of the building with the words free food painted on it.
Yeah, we like mainly find a lot of stuff like eggs and milk and potatoes.
This is a part of the ATX Free Fridge Project. The owners of Nixta Taqueria volunteered to host the first fridge open to the public back in August, and Coronado, for one, is grateful.
They didn't only just help my family put food on the table, but other people too. That really means a lot to me. It means a lot to me because the struggle is real. The struggle is real.
For those hurting like Coronado, the fridge and the pantry next to it are a lifeline. They act like a giant take-a-penny-leave-a-penny bowl. Local farmers and restaurants drop off produce and bread throughout the week. Neighbors and others also leave what they can. Even Coronado brought food to share.
You know, we had a lot of extra peanut butter and stuff at the house, so I brought them peanut butter.
It's this contagious sense of community camaraderie that first inspired Nixta owner Sarah Martin-Biggie and Chef Edgar Rico to participate in the ATX Free Fridge Project. After all, their restaurant was only open 4 months before the pandemic hit. The fact that they're still in business, Martin-Biggie says, is because of their community.
From the very beginning, there was sort of this idea of the solidarity. I don't have all the answers. I don't know what the future holds for Nixta. All I know is that people are really down, and seeing just the physical manifestation of something like this free fridge has been really beautiful to see.
Martin-Biggie and Rico are both children of immigrants. Rico's parents immigrated from Mexico, and Martin-Biggie's parents came from Iran. As entrepreneurs and partners, they've chosen to invest their life here in Austin's East Side.
For us, living in this neighborhood and seeing what we can do to try and combat some of those things like food insecurity, we're a restaurant, how do we use our resources? How do we use our collective community?
East Austin, though highly gentrified, is still home to many minority low-income families, groups that are most likely to be food insecure during and before the pandemic, says Patrick Stover.
Blacks and Hispanics had much higher rates of food insecurity than whites.
Stover is the vice chancellor and dean at Texas A&M University College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Because the pandemic reduced food access for many, community-supported fridges have been popping up all over Texas. Stover says across these households are the most vulnerable.
What we see in Texas, which is a real tragedy, is that children are feeling this the most. So not only do we see, again, the disparity amongst our underrepresented groups, we see that households with children faced even more severe consequences with the economic downturn leading to food insecurity.
Outside Nixta Taqueria, Coronado's daughter Ariana helps her parents choose from the fridge.
Oh, did you find something? What's that?
Ground meat.
Oh, ground meat.
Jeanette is on the phone with Coronado's mother.
Do you need some chili powder?
Direct chili powder?
Yeah.
Like for my noodle? Yeah, bring it over.
The family missed the most recent food bank pickup because Coronado was in the hospital. So the fridge adds just a bit more stability and peace of mind to the family's next meal, Jeanette says.
Yeah, I appreciate that help because there's sometimes when we run low on food and we don't have the money to go get it and we can come here.
Inside Nixa's kitchen, Chef Rico prepares one of their signature dishes. The Taqueria was named one of Food & Wine's best new restaurants of the year, a title that holds a different weight in a pandemic.
In these times of, you know, there's millions of people without jobs, to see that something so small like this, in which all it really takes is a little bit of electricity on our part, and, you know, it makes sense.
The colorful dining room hasn't been open to customers for about 7 months now. On a little windowsill is a tiny ofrenda with a picture of baby Rico and his grandmother cooking in the kitchen. It's a reminder that food brings us together, especially in hard times. For the Texas Standard, I'm Kristen Cabrera.
I lost my tío and tía. She was a hairdresser, so she always, from head to toe, looked amazing. And she had this beautiful ring with flowers of different colors, pastels, and I looked at it and I said, oh my gosh, I love it. She took it right off her finger and put it on mine and said, it's yours, mijita. I think people went to her for years because they felt loved by her. My tío, he was a jokester. I remember as kids, you know, we'd go do Easter egg hunts there and he'd chase my brother around with a pair of scissors saying, I'm going to cut your hair, mijo. And my brother would be like, ah! So it was fun to see their dynamic and to see how much they loved each other. My cousin found a picture of them from when they were just starting to date and my uncle was in the Army Reserves and my tía would send him, and now we'd call them selfies, I guess back then, you know, she'd just set self-portraits and she'd write on the back, my only wish is that we never part. I love you.
The voice of Ileana Rodriguez honoring Yolanda and Rolando Garcia from San Juan, Texas. This is a special edition of the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. 65% of COVID-19 deaths in San Antonio have been within the city's Hispanic or Latinx communities. That makes this Día de los Muertos particularly difficult because families can't get together to celebrate their loved ones. As the Texas Standard's Jill Amond reports, one organization in San Antonio is combining its love of monarch butterflies with helping community members remember those they've lost this year.
On San Antonio's south side, where the San Pedro Creek connects with the San Antonio River, there's a park aptly named Confluence Park. On a Sunday in mid-October, a small group of local artists and monarch butterfly enthusiasts are putting together an ofrenda in the park near these converging bodies of water. The altar features many of the traditional Dia de los Muertos offerings, pan de muerta, the traditional sweet bread, orange and yellow marigolds, sugar skulls, a shot of tequila. But unique to this ofrenda is its focus on monarch butterflies. There's monarch statuettes and plants that attract these butterflies. The group gathered here will release hundreds of monarchs near the ofrenda. Many of the butterflies will be tagged in honor of someone from the community who died from COVID-19. Monica Mackley is the founder and director of the Monarch Butterfly and Pollinator Festival in San Antonio.
These are not just numbers. These are people with families who are mourning and grieving, and it's very difficult to do that right now where you can't even hug each other, can't gather, you know, we can't do the potluck supper or the wake or the celebration, and so...
Mackley says typically festival participants would be celebrating the millions of monarchs making their way through San Antonio after traveling thousands of miles from northeast of the Rocky Mountains. They're the only butterfly that annually migrates south through central Texas to the mountains of southern Mexico, similarly to birds and bats.
So we're in a very unique spot geographically, a very strategic spot where all these different cultures come together, all these different ecosystems come together, all these different creatures come together.
Mack Lee and a small team of researchers and citizen scientists invite the community to come out for a day to learn more about the monarch's travels during the festival.
So they go down there in October or November. They go into what's called diapause, which is a semi-hibernative state. They hang out until late February, March, and then they get up. They have a butterfly orgy, and then the males often die, and the females start flying north to deposit those eggs, and the cycle starts all over again.
They also tag and release migrating monarchs for scientific research. Mackley demonstrates how to safely tag a monarch.
Hold the butterfly with its wings together close to its body so it's not flailing around and hurting itself. And then you always put the tag on this cell.
Monarchs are tagged on the part of their wing with a small circular sticker. The stickers have letters and numbers that identify the researchers they belong to, their weight, and their sex. Tagging monarchs migrating to Mexico helps researchers track their flight patterns. The coronavirus pandemic has forced Mackley to move her festival online this year. She, along with many San Antonians, are also trying to cope with losing friends and family to COVID-19.
And we also decided to focus on the spiritual aspect of the monarch migration because the monarchs typically arrive in Michoacán in the high altitude mountains right around Day of the Dead.
This year, people were asked to submit the names to the festival of someone they lost in 2020, either to COVID-19 or another cause. Those loved ones' names will be added to the databases for individual monarchs that are tagged. Adriana Rocha Garcia represents San Antonio City Council District 4.
The district that I represent is an underinsured community. We have folks that work two or three jobs to make ends meet, and a majority of my district is Hispanic. A lot of the folks in my district are also over the age of 55.
More than 13% of COVID-19 deaths in San Antonio have been people living in Rocha Garcia's district. But not only has the novel coronavirus hit her constituents hard, it's also hit her own family hard. She's lost six cousins and an uncle to COVID-19, so she's requested several monarchs be tagged in their memories.
Ever since I was young, I was taught that butterflies, monarch butterflies specifically, were that reminder that our loved ones, you know, would come back to visit us.
The monarch's ancient flight path connects Rocha Garcia to her loved ones. That symbolism can be traced back to indigenous tribes of Mesoamerica. They associated the monarch and butterflies in general with the life cycle and the afterlife. Aimé Villarreal is the director for the Center of Mexican American Studies and Research at Our Lady of the Lake University in San Antonio.
They go into this period of transformation in which they're in a cocoon, and we can liken that to death. And then are reborn in such a radical way that's extremely different from where they started.
Villarreal says indigenous people also associate butterflies with the changing of the seasons, the setting and rising of the sun, plant fertility, and the harvest. She says when Spanish colonialism arrived in Mesoamerica, many native people were forced to convert to Catholicism, but they still found ways to blend their beliefs with this European religion.
Día de los Muertos is a, of course, Catholic tradition associated with All Souls Day, but also has been kind of superimposed and blended with indigenous traditions associated with death, rebirth, and regeneration.
This is also a female.
On that Sunday in mid-October at Confluence Park, as the finishing touches are being put on the ofrenda, Monica Mackley and her team of butterfly researchers are tagging around 200 monarch butterflies nearby. 10 butterflies at a time are released near the ofrenda.
Hasta la victoria. Hasta la vista.
Some of the monarchs stick around the ofrenda for a little bit. They land on its pollinator plants and marigolds, near the dozens of photos of loved ones adorning the altar. Siva Ely is a local teacher and musician. She's brought a hand-carved flute to play a song for the butterflies as they're released.
As the butterflies take flight and go on their journey, it'll almost be like a blessing from them to me and from me to them, I guess, on their journey.
Other monarchs are released and seem eager to continue their journey, immediately flying towards the San Antonio River. If all goes well, these butterflies should be arriving in southern Mexico soon, just in time for Dia de los Muertos. In San Antonio, I'm Jill Ament for the Texas Standard.
Piece by piece, with images, music, food, and color, our virtual ofrenda came together. It was a labor of love by the entire Texas Standard team. Please pay your respects to the Texans who have passed at texasstandard.org/ofrenda. I'm Joy Diaz.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit texaspublicmedianetwork.com.